ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय We'll be reading this morning the first two verses of chapter 18, canto 5. Residents of Jambudweep offer prayers, and the descent of the Ganges, concluding with Lord Shiva's prayers to the Personality Godhead, have just completed. Here's the introduction to the chapter, kind of chapter summary at the very beginning. In this chapter, Shukadeva Goswami describes the different varshas. Varshas means tracts of land, territories. The different varshas of Jambudweep. And the incarnation of the Supreme Lord worshipped in each. The predominating ruler of Bhadrashva Varsha is Bhadrashrava. He and his many servants always worship the incarnation known as Lord Hayagriva. At the end of each kalpa, when the demon Ajnana steals the Vedic knowledge, Lord Hayagriva appears and preserves it. He then delivers it to Lord Brahma. In the land known as Hari Varsha, the exalted devotee Prahlad Maharaj worships Lord Nrisingadev. The appearance of Lord Nrisingadev is described in 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Following in the footsteps of Prahlad Maharaj, the inhabitants of Harivarsha always worship Lord Nrisingadev to receive from him the benediction of being engaged in his loving service. In the tract of land known as Ketumala Varsha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Rishikesh, appears in the form of Cupid, with a capital C, as opposed to the demigod of the same name. There's a demigod, Cupid is an expansion, partial expansion of the Personality of Godhead. It's a long description in the 10th canto, Pradyumna. But here it's Lord Rishikesh. The goddess of fortune and the demigods living there engage in his service day and night, maintaining himself in 16 parts. Lord Rishikesh is the source of all encouragement, strength, and influence. The conditioned living entity has the defect of being always fearful, but simply by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he can rid himself of this defect of material life. Therefore, the Lord alone can be addressed as Master. In the tract of land known as Ramyaka Varsha, Manu and all the inhabitants worship Matsyadev to this very day. Matsyadev, whose form is pure goodness, is the ruler and maintainer of the whole universe, and as such, he is the director of all the demigods headed by King Indra. In Hiranmaya Varsha, Lord Vishnu has assumed the form of a tortoise, Kormadev, Kormamurti, and is worshipped there by Aryama, along with all other residents. Similarly, in the tract of land known as Uttarakuru Varsha, Lord Srihari has assumed the form of a boar, and in that form he accepts service from all the inhabitants living there. Paragraph. All the information in this chapter can be fully realized by one who has associates one who associates with devotees of the Lord. Therefore, in the Shastras, it is recommended that one associates with devotees. This is better than residing on the banks of the Ganges. In the hearts of the pure devotees reside all good sentiments as well as all the superior qualities of the demigods. In the hearts of the non-devotees, however, there cannot be any good qualities, for such people are simply enchanted by the external illusory energy of the Lord. Following the footsteps of devotees, one should know that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the only worshipable deity. Everyone should accept this proposal and worship the Lord, as stated in Bhagavad Gita 15:15. Vedaishchasaya vair aham eva vedya. The purpose of studying the Vedic literature is to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. If, after studying all the Vedic literature, one does not awaken his dormant love for the Supreme Lord, it is to be understood that he has labored for nothing. He has simply wasted his time. Lacking attachment for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he remains attached to family life in this material world. Here comes the bombshell. Thus, the lesson of this chapter is that one should get out of family life and completely take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Nice conclusion. Text number one, there's nothing on the board because this is prose, and I'm not even going to attempt to read the prose. I'm not a good Sanskritist. Here's the translation. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, Bhadrashrava, the son of Dharmaraj, rules the tract of land known as Bhadrashva, Varsha. Just as Lord Shiva worships Sankarsana in Ilavrata, Varsha, Bhadrashrava, accompanied by his intimate servants and all the residents of the land, worships the plenary expansion of Vasudev known as Hayashirsha. Lord Hayashirsha is very dear to the devotees, and he is the director of all religious principles. Fixed in the topmost trance, Bhadrashrava and his associates offer their respectful obeisances to the Lord and chant the following prayers with careful pronunciation. No purport. Here's the prayer, text 2. The ruler, Bhadrashrava and his intimate associates utter the following prayer. We offer our respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the reservoir of all religious principles, who cleanses the heart of the conditioned soul in this material world. Again and again we offer our respectful obeisances unto him. And now Prabhupada's purport. Prabhupada's got his cutting away the affinity for matter bhav going. So, foolish materialistic persons do not know that they are being controlled and punished at every step by the laws of nature. They think they are very happy in the conditioned state of material life, not knowing the purpose of repeated birth, death, old age, and disease. Therefore, in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes such materialistic persons as mudhas, parentheses, rascals. Namam duskritano mudha prapadyante naradama. These mudhas do not know that if they want to purify themselves, they must worship Lord Vasudeva, Krishna, by performing penances and austerities. This purification is the aim of human life. This life is not meant for blind indulgence and sense gratification. In the human form, the living being must engage himself in Krishna consciousness to purify his existence. Tapo devyam putraka yena satvam shudyet. This is the instruction of King Rishabdev to his sons. In the human form of life, one must undergo all kinds of austerities to purify his existence. Yasmad brahma sokyam tvanantam. We are all seeking happiness. But because of our ignorance and foolishness, we cannot know what unobstructed happiness really is. Unobstructed happiness is called brahma sokya, spiritual happiness. Although we may get some so-called happiness in the material world, that happiness is temporary. The foolish materialist cannot understand this. Therefore, Prahlad Maharaj points out, Maya sukaya bharam udvahato vimudhan. Merely for temporary materialistic happiness, these vimudhan, these rascals, are making huge arrangements, and they are baffled life after life. I don't know if this is a editing matter. Jitendriya, are you going to write to Dravida about that question, the editing question we brought up yesterday? Huh? Sure. Could you have a, like, this amazing memory? Could you remember this one? In the chapter summary, it says Bhadrashrava worships Hayagriva. It says it twice. In the verse, it says he worships Hayashirsha twice. So, are they the same person, Hayagriva and Hayashirsha, or what? Is it an editing mistake? In the chapter summary, it's Hayagriva. In the verse, it's Hayashirsha. Twice and twice. Look at that. I couldn't hear you. They're the same person. Just two names for the same person. Horsehead, Hayashirsha, and Hayagriva. What does Griva mean? Okay. Thank you. Hayashirsha, Hayagriva. Could you do the assignment of finding out what Griva means? Let us know tomorrow morning. Whoops, I won't be here tomorrow morning. You can let me know. Well, it's a little difficult because he's departed, isn't he? Yeah, he's gone. Okay, so back to the verse. There's some easy parts, and there's some difficult parts, and there's some scratch-your-head parts of this fifth canto. And how to understand what's Jambudvip is one of the scratch-your-head ones. According to what I've understood, at least, from Sadaputta's writing, it can mean different things. Here we go. Here's a Sariputta little mini excerpt. According to Sariputta, the description of the universe found in Srimad Bhagavatam and the Vishnu Purana and Mahabharata and other references, specifically though in Srimad Bhagavatam, it is in one depiction, it's several different models of the universe. He gives two examples from a painting. There's a painting he presents in his book and also his little DVD. There's a biblical story and there's also a Bhagavatam story. The biblical story is a picture of one of Christ's disciples, the fisherman, whose name I can't remember, who captures a fish, and when he brings his net in and he opens up the fish, inside the fish there's a gold coin. So there's a picture of the fisherman catching the fish. And then in the middle is one painting. And then that same person is having a conversation with a tax collector from the government. And then there's some other people there. And the issue that's being demanded of the fisherman is, who does this belong to? The gold coin. Does it belong to the government? Or does it belong to God? Or does it belong to you? They're like trying to catch the followers of Christ and like, you know, find him breaking the law so they can put him in jail and, you know, keep him out of the public eye. And then the last picture is, the fisherman is handing the gold coin to the tax collector. One painting, and if you know the biblical story, it makes sense. It's depicting a series of events in one painting. And if you don't know the story, it's confusing. Because here's the fisherman, here's the fisherman, here's the fisherman, here's the tax collector, here's the tax collector, and in one painting. It's confusing. And then there's some people, and then there's no people, and then, so, you know, what's going on? It's a little bit like that with the Bhagavatam. What's going on? Then another is he shows a painting of Brahma Vimohan Lila. There's the picture of Brahma flying over the place where the cowherd boys and Krishna are having their lunch and the cows are nearby, the calves, and he's on his swan carrier overseeing the scene. It's one painting, and then the next scene is he's taking the cows and putting them in a cave, and you see Krishna and the cowherd boys sitting having their lunch. And then the next picture is, in the same painting, is Lord Brahma offering prayers to Krishna. So if you know the Leela, it's really nice. If you don't know the Leela, it's confusing. Sariputta asserts, similarly, in the fifth canto, there's several models which are not being differentiated. Now we're talking about this model, now we're talking about that model, and now we're talking about another model, and there's four models. And if you don't know what the models are, if you don't know the story, you know, it's what's going on. That's where we're left commonly, like what's going on. So, without going into further, you know, what Sariputta says, how that there's four models thing applies to this chapter, I don't know. He maybe says it and I don't know what he says, but and maybe he's not got it right, I don't know. But so, it could be, this earth planet and their different tracts of land on the earth planet, at least Central Asia, is one of the four models. And then there's a vertical model, you know, planets within the lower, middle, and upper planetary systems. That's another model. And then a third model is the model of our solar system. And I don't know which one this one is referring to, but don't worry about it. Your path back to Godhead is not being blocked because you don't know. Minimally, we're getting the indication there are different varshas, whether it's on this planet or in the universe or wherever it is. There are places where personalities reside, specifically because we're a little familiar with Prahlad Maharaj, Harivarsha. And Prahlad Maharaj in Harivarsha is worshipping, guess who? Lord Nrisimhadev. And he, following him, the associates of Harivarsha are also worshipping Lord Nrisimhadev. And we are going to hear in this chapter the prayers of Prahlad and his associates in Harivarsha as they offer their prayers to Lord Nrisimhadev. And that's the part that's consistent, and it's like really easy. That's the really easy part. Is elevated souls worship the personality of Godhead. And according to location and according to mood, there's different forms of the personality of Godhead that are exhibited to the residents. And they love that form, and he reciprocates with their love, and that's bhakti. The personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes, has great affection for his devotees, and the devotees have great affection for him. And it's the position of transcendental love. Now these are all places within this material world. You know, it's where we are in the material world, Devidam. And it behooves us, following these exalted souls, to worship the personality of Godhead. And there's different moods of worship of the personality of Godhead, and we're getting a nice display or array of the moods of worshiping the personality of Godhead. Here's another example of that. In the second chapter of Canto 10, there's prayers by the demigods to Krishna, who's in the womb of Devaki. And each demigod, according to their position and their mood, they offer prayers. And different prayers according to their different moods, although it's one person. Krishna within the womb of Devaki. Similarly, in Canto 7, when the demigods come before Lord Nrisimhadev to offer their prayers to pacify him, you can make a correlation between the prayers they offer to Krishna and the same demigod, the prayer they offer to Lord Nrisimhadev. There's symmetry in their mood. And they respect and worship and offer prayers to the same. And it's different to the next demigod, but it's the same person, same supreme person. Now in this case, it's different names. And Hayashirsha, horse-headed. Yes, Shirsha means head. So, neck. Shirsha means neck. Okay, so in this case, the forms are different, but we should understand it's the same person, supreme person. Just as it's said here, the Well, the personality, I can't find the reference right now. He's situated in the personality of Godhead is beyond the influence of matter. He has a form, and his form is spiritual. And although it may have some semblance to something, a tortoise or a lion, half man, anyway, it may have some semblance to something of this world, that the form of the Lord is fully transcendental. And so what he delivers is also fully transcendental. And the worshipers of the Supreme Lord should see him. We should see him as fully transcendental. And the more that we can see him fully as fully transcendental, the less interference or static there'll be in the mood of devotion and prayer. So, I wanted to spend a little bit of time on a question that was brought up in a discussion yesterday with one devotee about Prabhupada's strong language. And he starts the purport, "Foolish materialistic persons." Rascals, Lord Krishna describes the materialistic persons as mudhas, rascals, and, you know, several times. So, why that harsh tone and language? So here's three things that to help appreciate why the strong language. In the last part of the purport, Prabhupada is quoting Prahlad Maharaj speaking in the same language as Krishna speaks in Bhagavad Gita. Avajananti mam mudha manushim tanam ashritam. His is maya sukaya param udvahatovi mudhan. This is not only mudha, but vi mudhan. Like particularly rascal-like. What is, Prahlad Maharaj is not harsh. He's a little boy. And he's very gentle. Very, very gentle. In face of Hiranyakashipu, he remains gentle. In dealing with his classmates, he remains gentle. And yet when he's speaking to his father, he's using this term. So I'm going to read the verse. This is Prahlad offering prayers to Lord Nrsingadev. That's where this appears, chapter 9 from Canto 7. O best of the great personalities, Prahlad speaking to Lord Nrsingadev, I am not at all afraid of material existence. For wherever I stay, I'm fully absorbed in thoughts of your glories and activities. As Prabhupada is stating in his purport, fear is something that conditioned souls carry, but they can go on the other side of fear by shelter in transcendence. Because where there's shelter in transcendence, what is there to fear? Whatever there is that's of, if we fear, we may lose something. Of course, we are going to lose whatever it is that's of this material world. But being attached, being afraid of losing your money or losing your friends or family members or losing your life or whatever, losing your wallet or whatever people are afraid of losing. But when one sees those things as temporary and the position of shelter of the personality of Godhead as a position of real permanent well-being, then there's no fear of loss of something, which is here today and gone tomorrow, or maybe in the next moment it's gone. One isn't protective of things of this world. The Lord is my protector, and that which I require, he'll take care of, and my real position is his shelter. So Prahlad is saying like that, I feel no fear. The demigods, they're seeing your form, and they're afraid, because you're roaring so loudly, and your big pinching teeth and sharp claws, and they're afraid. But I'm not afraid, because I know those are meant for the non-devotees, not for the devotees. Those are meant for the non-devotees, not the devotees. So I have no fear. That's the starting point. He's in his transcendental position. No fear in face of Lord Nrisimhadeva, in his still roaring position. And he accomplishes that by remembrance of the nine processes. One of them is Smaranam, and that's Prahlad's perfection. He's always remembering. And by always remembering, he's fearless. Then, my concern is only for the fools and rascals. There's the harsh speech. Who are making elaborate plans for material happiness and maintaining their families, societies, and countries. And then comes the last part. I am simply concerned with love for them. Why is he speaking, on the one hand, of fools and rascals, and then on the other hand, my only concern is love for them? Is it inconsistent to think of someone who's doing something that's very foolish and consider it foolish, at the same time feel love for that person? It's not inconsistent. And supposing, here's an expression that Prabhupada used on a number of occasions. When a gentleman sees a blind person heading for the ditch, they have to do something. They have to say something. A gentleman has to do that. And a transcendentalist like Prahlad Maharaj, who sees the misfortune of souls who are blindly attached. Again, emphasis on blind. They're blinded by their attachment to the temporary, trying to find happiness in the temporary. They're devoid of this Brahma-sukh, and they're chasing after Maya-sukh, illusory happiness. Maya-sukhaya, bharam. Bharam means a false burden or responsibility. I have to maintain my family. I have all these obligations. I have to. It's the Pralambasura mentality. I have all these things I've got to do. How can I take up spiritual life? I've got so many responsibilities. And in that, I'm finding a sense of happiness by working in an attached mood for illusory things, illusory responsibilities. Bharam. Udvahato. Udvahato means those who are creating their plans to maintain these responsibilities and call it happiness. And, you know, and responsible life. Now, short comment. In the West, Prabhupada remarked, one of the advantages of the degraded situation in America is people don't have attachment to family life. They don't have attachment. They just have attachment to sense gratification, but not so much the responsibilities of family life. And then, so religions in America that are very popular or becoming, spreading quickly, is they just place value in family. Like the Mormon faith. Very, very strong family values. And because the paucity or absence of family value, people like it because it helps them stay together and they really work at it. You know, like they really work at it. So, you know, their support structures for families. And, you know, somewhere God's in the picture, but, you know, a big deal is the family and, you know, have a big family and family support families and, you know, the importance of family life. It doesn't go well with what Prahlad Maharaj is saying. And so then in India, you know, it'll draw some chuckles, but it's very common and it's still going on when some member of the family, the younger member of the family, children or whatever, relative, starts taking up Krishna consciousness, the parents go, uh-oh. They may renounce their worldly responsibilities. Like, you know, drop out of society and become a renunciate. So they say, you know, in moderation, but don't become a fanatic. And they, you know, like, anyway, you from India, you know all of this. And from the parent's side, it's protecting their children so that they can grow in a responsible way within society. They're thinking very, in a very caring way about their dependents or their loved ones. And, you know, maintain the family structure. Because within the family, minus the family structure, things become very degraded, very quick, like in the West. Very degraded, very quick. Very degraded, very quick. No support structure. So, we're aspiring transcendentalists, where we're hearing from Prahlad Maharaj the lamentation or concern. He says it twice. My concern is only for the fools and rascals who are making elaborate plans for material happiness and maintaining their families, societies, and countries. I am simply concerned with love for them. So his concern of love and his concern of identifying them as foolish and rascals are not, they're not contradictory feelings. So what does a transcendentalist do? Well, Prahlad Maharaj spoke to his classmates. He didn't, you know, call them fools and rascals. He spoke about the futility of finding happiness through material activity and step by step in different stages of life, because they were saying, no, we're young, we want to play. No. At every stage, there's something that will keep you distracted and employed and totally wrapped up and bound in pursuit of happiness. At different stages of life, it's there. That's his instruction to his classmates. So let us take up, by his association, they took up. And they got slammed by the adults. Where did you get this? And, you know, it brought at least the attempted murder of Prahlad by his father for doing such a thing. But he was fearless, and the Lord protected him. So, is there room for strong language when there's love? And the answer is absolutely. And what if you say the same thing in soft language? For someone who's attached, for someone who's tuned into soft language, then, you know, they can take the soft language message. And that's very nice. And then what if people don't, they're not tuned into soft language? And they keep, the blind person keeps heading for the ditch because they're attached. And then what? They fall in the ditch. And is the gentleman being responsible to just, okay, I'll speak softly, knowing they'll keep going and fall in the ditch? Now, there's two other things. We cannot imitate a liberated soul. We should not, Prabhupada said this, you cannot speak like I speak. I'm an old man. I can get away with it. You can't do like that. Of course, if you have a relationship with certain people, you can do like that. But if you don't have the relationship with people, you cannot do the like. But Prabhupada was, from his position as a empowered acharya, assigned by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur to take the message of Lord Chaitanya delivered to the English-speaking parts of the world, and contemplating in advance before he came and when he arrived and when he was here, how are these people going to understand this message? They're so steeped in ignorance and passion. How are they going to understand the message of transcendence? They're heading for the ditch. So he, not always, but certainly, you know, and not on a number of occasions, he used very strong language. Why? Same as Prahlad. Out of love, of deep concern. Deep concern. And so such persons, if I speak softly, are they going to hear? I may have to speak strongly. And then maybe they'll hear. Now, maybe because of speaking strongly, some people back off and say, oh, this man speaks strongly. Are those persons going to accept if he speaks softly? Instead of back off because he speaks strongly? That's a judgment call that our founder Acharya made. He sometimes, in many cases, spoke very strongly, out of love. And that's the important thing, is to understand the place from which the speaking is coming, not exactly the speech, but the place from which the speaking is coming. Deep, deep concern. And then the last thing, I remember Jitendra will remember along with me that video or the film of Prabhupada sitting in his garden in the side of the Los Angeles temple with all the professors sitting there, and Prabhupada was using, you know, rascal, and one of the professors says, Swamiji, you know, very respectfully, Swamiji, why do you use this word rascal? It's very strong. And Prabhupada wasn't unaware of how strong. He said, you know, maybe you can say foolish. And Prabhupada moved his head and said, rascal is sum total of all foolishness, or something like that. And laughed, and they laughed, and he just moved on. Then, in the end, towards when Prabhupada was leaving the world, he requested for his godbrothers who were living in Vrindavan and elsewhere to come see him, and he apologized explicitly. On many occasions, I used very strong language. And he said, please excuse me for my offense. And they said, no, no, Swamiji, your intention was for preservation of pure devotional service. We understand your intention. There's no offense. There's no need to request forgiveness. No need to give forgiveness. We understand your intention. Something to that effect. Not quoting verbatim, but something to that effect. So on the one hand, he, you know, strong. And then on the other hand, it was the place from which it was coming was a place of love and deep concern. So, we cannot imitate. We must not imitate. But sometimes, depending upon the circumstance, and part of the circumstance is the relationship, is someone may speak strongly. One devotee commented to me once, "Maharaj, you never chastise me." "And is that because you think I can't take it?" I said, "Definitely." "Because you can't take it, I don't chastise." "Can you please chastise?" I said, "I don't think you can take it, but I'll experiment. But not right now." So later, "Wild! Oh! Ooh!" I said, "I told you, you can't take it." And what's the consequence of not chastising or not correcting a person when they're heading for the ditch? Is they'll fall in the ditch. But such people, because they can't take it, they have to learn the hard way. Some people just have to learn the hard way. The school of hard knocks, as they say. Just because they can't take it. But when you receive a strong message and you know that the person is speaking from a position of deep concern, like Prahlad, and love for the person, take it in the right way. It's to help me not fall in the ditch. It's to keep me in the middle of the road, in a safe position. It's kindness. And we can't always take that kind of kindness. We like the other kind. And part of the problem with the other kind is take it or leave it, depending upon how attached we are. And especially if we're really attached, we leave it. And then we fall in the ditch, or we have a problem that was, it's just unnecessary. Just stay in the middle of the road. Stay fixed in the process of pursuing shelter in the personality of Godhead exclusively, and don't dilly-dally over here. Here's one chastisement from Prabhupada. This is a morning walk in Mayapur. There was a conversation about, you know, some devotees are doing this, Prabhupada, and, you know, what should be done? And Prabhupada, rather than addressing the particular, he said, "You Western people, devotees, you like to flirt with Maya. It is like," and he paused, "and it's like going out on a branch and seeing how far out on the branch you can go before you hear the branch starting to crack, and then you run back to the trunk of the tree. But sometimes the branch breaks. You Western devotees are like that." It was a chastisement. And it's true. But, you know, with that, the curiosity thing, how far out can I go before, Devamrita Maharaj calls it, he uses a sports analogy. It's like, you know, the catcher that's running down the sideline and he'll catch the pass, and it's just like right on the edge of the out of bounds. And he's, there are some devotees that live their life like that, like right on the edge. They're not like out, but they're, you know, like right on the edge. And they get a thrill out of that. And it's not safe. We don't like to see devotees in that risky position. Some people like the risky position. How far out can I go before I'm out of bounds? Or the branch breaks. So stay close to the, you know, the fidelity with our teachings, and certainly in this matter of fundamental finding happiness in pursuit of temporary sense objects and bringing the senses to the sense objects and getting them and finding happiness, that tendency is so strong. And to hear strong language to check that tendency is needed. It's coming from a place of love, as we're finding in Prabhupada's purport here. Hare Krishna. Any comments or questions? Yes.
Maharaj, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says about the role of chastity of women and how it can create Varna Sankara.
Yes.
So, could we explain a little bit more role of chastity? Because I don't see it in the society, especially here in the West.
In you India, do or you don't see it?
I don't see it.
Chastity. You don't see unwanted children?
I don't see chastity.
Oh, okay.
Because what I see is like they move from one relationship to another relationship to another relationship. Like that's not chastity.
Yeah.
And also I have seen the other side in India growing up, that even if it's the worst relationship, like they just stay together, the husband and wife.
That's religious. Hmm? That's religious. And the bind is religious vow. So what would you like me to speak about? You're making a comment. What would you like me to speak about? Just acknowledge, yes, it's true, there's not chastity.
No, like as devotees, what are we supposed to do?
What are we supposed to do? Be chaste. Be chaste. And be an example of that chastity. That's what we're supposed to do. And speak its message. That's what we're supposed to do. But more important is setting a nice example. I'm tempted to say something from Prabhupada's teachings that may appear to be a little contradictory to your statement or the statement just made. There are places in Prabhupada's writings where he says that fidelity is necessary provided the husband is I can't recall the exact language, but it's not sinful. And if there is, there's a point where in Prabhupada's teachings, if the husband is sinful or whatever, demoniac or is going by in their life going further and further and further and further and further away from Krishna, one may not be, when one's obligation to follow is no longer there. I should get the exact language because it's important that it's what Prabhupada said and not something that he didn't say. But something like that. And in those occasions, Prabhupada would say, make Krishna your husband. Because this was the early part where boys and girls came and they became married, and then, the husband would go cuckoo. And then what's the wife supposed to do when the husband goes cuckoo? And he would give this example. Make Krishna your husband. That's pretty elevated. But when stay protected, because that's an important position to be in, is to be protected for a woman to be. But the difficulty, Prabhupada also said, the difficulty for women is the lack of qualified men. And therefore, he was saying, women have become, they want independent and equal rights because there aren't qualified men. So the responsibility shouldn't be simply the women has to be infidelity with unqualified people, but the men should be qualified and the women should be faithful. The difficulty is a qualified person to be faithful to. So therefore the training of men is equally as important as the training of women to be faithful. Without both of them, it's a mess. And abusiveness is an example of, you know, where one need no longer remain faithful. For example. Having had to deal with situations like that where, you know, the husband is violent and the wife is supposed to be faithful. Sometimes verbally, sometimes physically, sometimes both. And, you know, I have to be faithful to my husband. If I, you know, I've got bruises all over me and stuff like, you know, it's like, you can't do that. Can't do that. Anything else? Jitendriya.
Wasn't Dhritarashtra's wife considered to be the emblem of chastity?
Yes, she's one of some
exalted. You
know, special exalted personalities.
But she
females.
Had to tolerate quite a bit. She had to tolerate quite a bit.
She sure did. She knew better, but she also had her attachment. She was also, in addition to being faithful to her husband, she was also attached like her husband to her sons being the king and so on. To a degree she was like that too.
Prabhupada called Dhritarashtra, he was blind spiritually and
materially.
He says he was a fool.
Yeah. Anything else? Yes, Jai Jagannath.
This only took up a small portion of the discussion, but you were mentioning about the different moods of devotion of the devas.
Yeah.
In relationship to the Supreme Lord. Anyway, this is a very classic question, but that I've asked particularly several occasions about like-minded association.
Which kind?
Like-minded association.
Okay.
We learn in the Nectar of Devotion of the five most important angas. One of them is, of course, sadhu sangha, but the language that is particularly used is like-minded association. And so I was kind of wondering, again, like I said, I've asked this question many times, but accommodating this variety of moods of devotion and the like-minded association. Reconciling these two, particularly in a situation where you feel that you're not amongst like-minded association in terms of a mood of devotion. That's the particular scenario that I'm thinking of.
Well, here's some thoughts on that. Unity and diversity is the initial thought. Even within like-minded association, there's diversity. Amongst the associates of Srimati Radharani, there are different personalities. You know, then there's the right-wing and left-wing gopis, but even amongst the left-wing gopis, they're of different mindedness, different ways of responding to situations. And they while they had some of their like-minded associates, you know, general left-wing, they were able to associate, and they, you know, circumstantially they associated with all different types. You know, and let's say, you know, interactions with the Cowherd Boys, the Gopas and the Gopis. That, you know, intimate friends of Krishna and intimate friends of Radharani, and they would have different types of interactions, sometimes seemingly, you know, very feisty and sometimes very wonderful. I'm thinking of one pastime at Man Mandir where Subal, who sometimes is on the other side, but Subal and Vishakha had conspired, had planned together a meeting of Radha and Krishna. Only, and so Radha was at the appointed place at the right time, and Krishna got waylaid because Padma approached Krishna saying, Chandravali is in great distress, and somehow persuaded Krishna to go spend some time, and it took longer than he thought it would take. And anyway, so sometimes even with differences, there's, you know, speaking now of Krishna's eternal pastimes, there are times when there's complete harmony, there's times when there looks like dissidence. Then coming down to our position, the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they, even amongst the six Goswamis, there were differences of disposition, but then there were similarities which they shared, and they would engage in Krishna Katha together, although of different moods. Or coming down a little bit, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Very different moods, very different approach. And they would, Bhaktisiddhanta would sometimes criticize Bhaktivinoda. At the same time, he had greatest respect for him. And sometimes Bhaktivinoda would chastise Bhaktisiddhanta. So there, and now in our position, we're just like, trying to become, you know, attached to Krishna. Trying to get out of, you know, the other kind. And that like-mindedness is what's important. And then there's diversity. Like so much diversity. And within international society, my goodness, so much diversity. I was appreciating when we did during this yatra, and I've seen it in other circumstances, the Chinese devotees stay together. There are like 20 of them, and they all stay together. So some of the devotees were trying to give association to them, so they would feel accepted. But they were kind of like keeping to themselves. There's a nature to do like that. But then once they got to know one another, you know, because of language differences, but it was a little difficult, very strong relationships developed, although culturally very different. So especially for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, looking at the big picture, for having appreciation for others who are different, and yet there's some essences, and then going down a little more into, you know, our lifestyle. Something that one of the devotees who was I'll just leave his name out because it's not important, but you know, when it was the airport party and there were devotees doing book distribution at the airports all over the country, some of them like superlatively excellent, expert. But when we would go to Mayapur, they would spend their time not just with the book distributors, with different people and establish relationships and, you know, sharing with them. It's really nice to appreciate another devotee and their mood and their service and their realizations from their service. And then, you know, their interest in hearing what your realization from your service and, you know, the cross-pollination that makes for unity within diversity. So some, summary, it's some opportunity for like and some opportunity for diverse, kind of like the Old Testament. There's a time, there's a season for all things. There's a time and place for coming together with like-minded persons. There's a time and place for diversity, especially, emphasis, especially in light of the desire of Lord Chaitanya, that let the people of the world come to hear the message of Lord Chaitanya, which Bhaktisiddhanta, for example, made a strong emphasis in his approach, the four sampradayas, and one can look at the differences, but, you know, he made emphasis of the similarities while honoring and respecting the differences. It was like a strong part of Lord Chaitanya's message and mood to bring them together, you know, around the holy name, the Yuga Dharma. But, you know, so that there's differences. There's differences in mood. But there's also, there's a lot of similarity in an important level, not necessarily the deepest of levels, but the important level and of devotion to the personality of Godhead. And by that, then there can be, appreciation and elevation. So time for both is my thought. Okay, and there, thank you very much, Prabhupada.